You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Kia ora whānau, e whakarongo ana koutou ki te reo irirangi e wa Takaumarima BFM. Ko rahira ahau, it is nearly 20 to 8 and we have got Dr. Shane Reti from the National Party on the line. Morena, Dr. Shane, how are you?
Kia ora koutou e hoa mai, e pai ana.
It is so great to have you on the show. It's our first chat with you. And since you've taken on the role of National Party Deputy Leader, you're also in the portfolios of children and health. And those are some big jobs to be taking on at this time. How are you feeling about this this kind of new direction for the National Party? You've got quite a big shift in the lineup and a big, I guess, mandate to change as a party. What are some of your original thoughts going into this new era?
Look, I think you're exactly right. I think it's your last statement there. We've got that mandate to change. We've been permission to refresh and to look different and to be relevant back out to the voters again. And so we're going to take that opportunity. And we're actually quite excited to be able to do that. What it's meant is the large number of portfolios have been spread amongst us. So as you say, both health and children are big portfolios in their own right. Normally, you'd just hold health by itself, just like you'd hold education by itself because it's so momentous. But we thought there was an important interface between health and children, particularly child poverty, and so we put these two together. So I have the privilege of leading both of those out, and of course we've got coronavirus still sitting all amongst us, and Chris Bishop's leading out that particular part of the response. But yeah, two big portfolios, and really excited to be amongst it. I've been with health and the Health Select Committee for 6 years already, so I understand this domain quite intimately. And it's nice to get my hands into the children poverty portfolio and see if we can make a difference there as well.
Now, I do want to talk, obviously, a little bit about COVID because it's pretty unavoidable in this time. But let's focus a little bit on the children portfolio first, because I am interested to hear what your vision for that is, because we are seeing some massive ongoing problems in Aotearoa. These are, you know, generations deep problems now of child poverty. We're seeing, of course, the huge reports coming out about Oranga Tamariki and some seriously concerning stuff happening there. What would you like to, I guess, change or action in your role? What are you hoping from, I guess, this next term in this position?
Yeah, I'm particularly interested in the child poverty measures of material hardship. And what we know is that within that space, there's what's called economising behaviours. That is, if you are impoverished, these are the things you don't do. And the seven measures that we keep an eye on to assess where we're going with material hardship and child poverty. And what we know at the moment, the four that are getting worse in order of magnitude that they're getting worse is doctor's visits. People are putting off their doctor's visits, fresh fruit and vegetables, keeping warm, and getting appliance repairs. And so I've got in my eyes, those are four areas we need to seriously think about. If the number one impact of impoverishment on children is that they don't access doctor's visits, what are the policy changes that need to resolve that? How do we measure it? How quickly can we move? So I'm very interested in these economising behaviours that we know are getting worse over the past 2 years than got better. So these aren't even standing still. We know what they are. Fresh fruit and vegetables. If you're impoverished, if you're below the poverty line, you choose not to get fresh fruit and vegetables. So what are the policy changes that might have an impact on that? What can we do? What can I do? What can we put forward that might make some difference around that? So I'm very interested in these four, first of all, because these are the four that are getting worse. And then the wider brief, of course, talks to housing, talks to employment, all the other measures that affect child poverty will be in my wider brief. But if you say, what are the four things that you're looking at? These are four policy changes right here, these economising behaviours that are getting worse that would have an impact that I'd really like to get my teeth into.
Now, one of the things that's come out of this COVID situation this year is a discussion around benefits and the level that our beneficiaries are living on in New Zealand. Of course, we saw a lot of immediate relief from the government across the COVID period, and that's kind of led to longer discussions about the rate of benefits in New Zealand, and perhaps that having a direct link, or definitely that having a direct link to child poverty. What are your thoughts around that, and particularly around the discussion about raising benefits in Aotearoa?
So this is a measure of the Child Poverty Action Group and the Children's Commissioner as well. These are some of the initiatives that they're proposing. I think if the goal is how do we lift the medium income, how do we lift the discretionary funding into families, that's a good goal. Where we may have differences is how we do that. Does the state give it to you? Or do I provide you with the job and the skills and the training so that you can generate it yourself? So the angle that we come to on this, I don't think anyone's disagreeing that if we can raise the level of income, then we would do better in the child poverty area. It's maybe just how we get there. And we're much more of a view that if I can provide you with the facilities, the resources and the training to have a job, that job will do actually more than just put more dollars in your pocket. And it's all of those benefits together that we'd like to be looking at.
Now let's talk a little bit about COVID, because we do have to. It's the elephant in the room of 2020. We have heard some discussion in the last 2 days, really, from the government about potential travel bubbles with Australia happening in the first quarter of next year. That is conditional, of course, but based on some things like 28 days of no community transmission and no great changes in the situation of either country. What are your thoughts around this? Are you pleased to hear that this is moving in this direction? Do you have some hesitations?
Yeah, so our COVID spokesman, Chris Bishop, will talk to this later today. Even I can see some announcements coming out. But fundamentally, we'd have to be a little bit disappointed that we've taken this long to get here. I mean, let's imagine Australia were available to us around about October the 16th. So we've been in parts of states of Australia we've been able to go to without the quarantine arrangements and so on. And yet here we are, we're going to miss the Christmas rush. Imagine if we had a border that was able to cope with visitors from Australia coming across for their Christmas experience. Imagine what that would do to our economy. And yet we're still uncertain exactly what date and exactly what shape and form those border arrangements or those bubbles, when they do open, what exactly that shape will be. And it just seems to us that this has been a long time. We've sort of had 5 months to figure this out. And yet we're still not certain exactly what date this would start, and exactly what the criteria are. Why is this taking so long is sort of our question. That needs a lot of thinking. And the cooks would come into that as well. It may well be that they're first off the mark as sort of a proof of concept, but this has been a long time. There's been a willingness, it would seem, between both governments. So where's the hurdle? Why are we taking so long? So generally pleased, of course we're pleased. That would be beneficial to both economies, not just from a tourism perspective, but particularly from a labour perspective as well, because, you know, we're short in workers working in our horticulture industry, for example. So, yes, we should be very pleased with well-formed bubbles, and underpinning all of that would be a safety factor. In our hands as well, this would need to be safe. Contact tracing would need to be immaculate. Border would need to be immaculate. We understand all of those things. And really, after 3 to 6 months, if the government hasn't figured that out, then there's issues beyond issues. But in that context, we're very supportive of the bubbles, and we really want the government to tell us, well, what is the schedule? Why is it taking so long?
In terms of immaculate borders, is the National Party still of the position that people should be tested before they get on a plane?
Absolutely, as is Japan, as is other countries. Pre-departure testing in our hands would be a requirement. When you think about it, the arguments as to why not just don't stand up. I mean, one of the first arguments is, oh, well, they may be falsely negative when they test. Well, yes, they could be positive too, by the way, as were two of the Russian seamen before they tried to come to New Zealand, and they were stopped back in Russia. So there was an effect right there of having pre-departure testing. The argument that, oh, they might catch it in transit, that's also got merits. Having said that, because we know New Zealanders have caught it in transit on the way out of the country. I think it was to Japan we had a New Zealander who we believe caught it in transit. But at least 40%, if not the majority, of people coming to New Zealand are coming from Australia or from the US, and they're a direct flight. They don't have transit, so that argument fails as well. I think the third argument of how do we know it would be an accredited test that was being well tested overseas? Well, you know, all your immigration New Zealand visas require medical testing across the world from accredited New Zealand laboratories, New Zealand accredited laboratories. We actually called the Russian testing facility that tests for immigration New Zealand and spoke with them, and they do exactly the same coronavirus testing that we do, the PCR nasal swab, yes, they could turn it around in 48 hours. So generally, you'd need a negative test 3 days before you hop on a plane. And thirdly, the cost was $50. And so really, I think all the arguments that are being put up, only by the government, I would add, epidemiologists outside of government have been calling like we have for months for this to be an important part of tightening up our border. I say to people, imagine or conceptualise it as just moving our border offshore a bit further. Think of pre-departure testing as that, and it's a good thing.
I just wanted to talk a little bit before we let you go as well about the sort of future of where we're going with COVID, because we're starting to see vaccines being rolled out around the world, specifically the Pfizer vaccine in the UK, and it's now been approved for the US as well. And that's part of the government's plan for next year, is getting some of those vaccines into Aotearoa, and they have also got others as well on the cards too. Are you feeling comfortable and confident with the direction that the government's vaccine program is moving in?
Okay, so we should be pleased, of course, that there's vaccines on the horizon. That gives us a real sense of hope, and I have a sense of hope with that, as should New Zealanders, so that's a good thing. I think there's several parts that we need to look at: procurement, logistics, and distribution. If we look at procurement, we understand that we have 1.5 million of the Pfizer vaccine. That's the double vaccine shot, so that would cover 750,000 people. We know it's got some logistics problems because it's actually messenger RNA, which we've never had vaccines before. It's got to be stored at minus 70 degrees Celsius. Mm-hmm. But I do understand the government is organising and has organised for cold storage facilities, so that's a good thing as well. The follow-up vaccine, the Janssen vaccine, there's 5 million doses. That's where most New Zealanders at this point are likely to receive their coronavirus vaccine from. And it's much more akin to what our ordinary vaccines are like, mm-hmm. the Janssen vaccine. It's a single dose. It can be stored at standard vaccine storage fridges like most general practices have. I guess, if we look at procurement, logistics and distribution, one of the issues to just think about, the procurement of the Janssen vaccine, it's a non-binding agreement. So we need an absolute commitment that we are going to get those vaccines, but as it stands here today, it's non-binding. Secondly, the logistics are much easier with the Janssen vaccine. It can go into GP fridges like other vaccines, so that's a good thing. And then with both vaccines, there's that question of distribution. What is a just distribution of vaccines? Or more specifically, who gets it first? And I think that's a discussion around who is most likely to catch it, and if they, who is most likely to catch it and die. Mm-hmm. And I think this is a discussion health officials and New Zealanders need to have when the vaccines do arrive here, who should receive it first. And I think in my mind, if we look at those two principles, who's most likely to catch it, and if they do catch it, who does poorly, it's probably healthcare workers in that first space, along with border workers, as the most likely to catch it. Mm-hmm. And then who is most likely to do poorly? Probably the elderly. And so in a very rough way, in my mind, with some early thinking, I'm thinking that's probably a fair distribution mechanism that New Zealanders would understand and say, yeah, that's probably fair. There may be other groups and nuances, but just very generally, how we distribute the vaccine, I think, is another piece of work that needs to be done.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for your time this morning, Dr. Shane Reti from the National Party. We really appreciate it, and we look forward to continuing these conversations in 2021.
And a Merry Christmas to you and your team.
Merry Christmas to you as well. Thank you.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.